10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one will be a look at the place of higher education in our modern democracy. In part two, we'll hear from the executive director of the Fifth House Ensemble, hearing about some of the spectacular performances that are going on in the near future as they conduct yet another Fresh Ink workshop at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. All that and more coming up on today's morning show. Certainly here in the state of Wisconsin, there has been a great deal of new discussion about the role of higher education in modern life. As sweeping cuts and other pressures come to bear against the university of system here in Wisconsin, and as other factors begin to bring this topic more and more to the core, it's a great opportunity to examine a very intriguing and thoroughly researched book called Democracy's Education, Public Work, Citizenship, and the Future of Colleges and Universities. This is a book which is edited by my morning show guest, Harry C. Boyd. It begins with an essay by Professor Boyd and then follows with a number of different essays by all kinds of different contributors weighing in on the topic of what public education, higher education, that is, should be in our modern world, and the kind of rich contribution which higher education is meant to make in our collective life as a society, and particularly as a democracy, not just responding to the changes that are all around us, but being an agent of change and an agent of betterment in the lives of all citizens. The guest I'm speaking to today, Harry C. Boyd, is senior scholar in public work philosophy at the Sabo Center for Democracy and Citizenship, housed at Augsburg College in the Twin Cities. Also a senior fellow at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs and a visiting professor at Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University in South Africa. The author of a number of different books, and his writings have appeared in a host of different publications. This book is published by Vanderbilt University Press, again titled Democracy's Education, Public Work, Citizenship, and the Future of Colleges and Universities. Professor Harry Boyd, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
Early in the opening essay, you make reference to the tsunami of changes sweeping over our institutions and society. Let's begin there. What are those changes that you characterize as a tsunami that are most relevant to the concerns which are raised in this book?
Yeah, good question. Well, certainly the changing role of technology and the age of the smart machines is central. If we're going on the path we are now on, it threatens huge unemployment in the next two or three decades. But I would say also a growing division in the society, kind of a balkanization. There's growing inequality in the society and segmentation by income and educational levels, as Robert Putnam describes in his new book, Our Kids. And then more broadly and more elusively but deeply, there's a sense of discouragement, a loss of hopefulness, a loss of confidence, which really was the genius of American society. Hmm.
And you are contending in this book, as are the various contributors, that higher education can play a very, very crucial role in combating all of those ills, and in particular, this last one, this sense of hopelessness, this lack of empowerment, which more and more people seem to feel, that whatever wheels are turning and moving the world, those are wheels which most of us have nothing to do with or no control over.
Yeah, absolutely. So the core argument of the book is that this is a time for the struggle of the soul of higher education, and connected to that, the meaning of America, where we're going as a civilization. I talked to a student yesterday who's preparing to be a citizen teacher, a change agent in a youth empowerment effort working with special education kids. She said, you know, this work is important, really important. I see all these changes in kids that are positive, but this is not only about these kids or my teacher program. This is about the future of our civilization.
One of the intriguing things about your essay and about much of the book is the way in which it sort of calls into question our rather simplistic understandings of very basic terms, terms like work, terms like public. Those are just two of them, but I think they're probably two of the most important terms that we should talk about. And I think we should begin with this notion of what it means for something to be public, and the way in which people as individuals and the institutions of society, like colleges and universities, need to be operating in a sense more publicly and encouraging people or fostering in people more of a notion of thinking publicly. How are you using the term public in this context?
No, that's a great question, Greg. So, you know, now we think of often, ironically, public as something out there. It's a government institution or something that is even alien. But public, of course, comes from the root word meaning people. So the challenge is to put the public back in public. And Wisconsin is a great example of this tradition. The university system in the Wisconsin idea understood its the colleges or universities' boundaries to be the boundaries of the state, and the whole people of the state to be involved in the business of education, not simply experts or professors or teachers. So I would say the fundamental point about this this challenge we face is to put the people back into all sorts of public settings and public institutions.
And I think that's an intriguing notion when we talk about something like higher education, because there are plenty of people out in the public, using that term now in that respect, who view public education as a luxury which belongs to other people and not to them, that for whatever reason is out of their reach. And to whatever extent that's a correct perception or not, it, in a sense, is a little bit at odds with what you were just describing.
No, it's strongly at odds. You know, we have to remember that, as Pogo said, we've met the enemy and he is us. It's really, this is a challenge that we all face as a society, how to become a productive citizenry again, not looking to others to either blame or fix things. But I would say higher education has partly contributed to the problem here, because increasingly the definition of what higher education is about has become focused on individual success. And, you know, the U.S. News & World Report, which does the rankings, college rankings each year, had an article last fall saying, is the bubble about to burst, and talking about the frenzy that we've developed as a society and young people feel about getting into the, quote, best colleges, and the kind of ratings wars, rankings wars, and prestige wars that we've developed. So we have to remember that democracy I think another term that we need to interrogate is democracy. Democracy in the American tradition, really until recent decades, didn't mean elections simply. Elections was only a piece of a much richer, broader, deeper understanding of democracy as a way of life. This is what I experienced as a young man, a college student, when I worked in the citizenship schools of Martin Luther King's organization. Everybody talked about democracy as something we built everywhere. It was not only about including blacks in the democracy that who had been excluded, but it was building community institutions and schools and healthy local economies, and everybody had a role and a part to play in that. So there was a deep, as recently as the 60s, there was a deep sense of democracy as a way of life. And higher education's purposes were not simply, or even most importantly, individual success. They were contributing to a democratic way of life. And this was across the board. So the land grant and public university system like Wisconsin, that was its identity. In the 30s and 40s, people talked about the university as a democracy college. But it was also Harvard. The president of Harvard, Charles Eliot, said, all of our faculty and students are fired and full of the democratic spirit. So we've lost a lot of that spirit. Mm-hmm. And so we need to recover a sense of the depth of not only public but democracy, I would say, and education is nourishing them.
Right. And what you were saying about kind of the frenzy for anybody who aspires to go to college to try to get into the best college they possibly can and so on, it reminds me, too, that so much of the rhetoric that surrounds the importance of going to college at all and getting a college education, so much of that rhetoric is really keyed towards the individual and the fact that if you don't go to college, then chances are for the rest of your life you're going to be relegated to a certain level of society and a certain stature of job that will be very, very limited compared to the possibilities that stretch before you if you are able to go to college. And, of course, all of that might be actually perfectly true or corrected in some respects, but it tends to foster something which gives you great concern.
Well, and of course it gives higher education great concern, because people rightly think, if college is a ticket for individual success, why should we pay for it? So you get an erosion of sense of public involvement and ownership of the education enterprise. That's a huge problem for higher education.
So you mean the person who's not going to that college, why should they have to pay?
Why should they pay for it?
Right, for somebody else's ticket to success.
Yeah, so the book has many stories of different ways this understanding of the democratic purposes of higher education, which were once so strong. I mean, the Truman Commission in 1947 declared the fundamental purpose of higher education was to advance democratic values and purposes, and this was not mainly about elections. But the book has stories like how colleges can use and think about their total resources. I mean, higher education now is over $1 trillion each year in economic activity. How can those resources and all the facilities and the meeting spaces and the technologies and the libraries, how can they be resources for communities? So a central question.
Right.
And another question is, how do we prepare students who graduate who don't think simply in terms of making a lot of money or individual success as the life goal, but actually think about what they can contribute to communities. We call that citizen professional, and how they can be innovators in creating the jobs communities need rather than focus narrowly on their individual success.
We're speaking with Harry C. Boyt about the book which he edited called Democracy's Education, Public Work, Citizenship, and the Future of Colleges and Universities. Professor Boyt offers up the opening essay in this book called Reinventing Citizenship as Public Work, and then there are a host of other essays then that are offered up which sort of respond to that and attack this central concern from a number of different angles and perspectives. In addition to the term public, of course, your essay also concerns itself, as does much of the book, with sort of enlarging our notion of the term work. And one of the things that made my eyes light up a little bit, being a Lutheran, was when I saw you quote Martin Luther at one point in your essay, in something that he once did when translating the Bible. And that is just one small part of what you're saying about the term work. But let's begin there.
Well, so I would say there are three concepts and histories in America that are woven together. Democracy as a way of life, education as preparing for democracy, and work as building democracy. Not simply for a private benefit, but work for the larger commonwealth, it was the term people used. So that meant a lot of different things. So, you know, the frontier tradition was settlers creating what historian Robert Wiebe calls portable democracy. They built towns and churches and schools and roads, and they developed a sense that they own democracy. People own democracy. But this continued, really. In fact, if again, the civil rights movement, if you look at it, another meaning of work with public meanings was work that makes a contribution to the society, gives you a kind of standing and authority. So I worked, as I said, for Martin Luther King when I was a college student. And if you remember, the bookends of King's career were the the maids who walked to work in the bus boycott in Montgomery in 1955 and 6, and the dignity that they conveyed in their work, boycotting the segregated buses, was transfixed the nation. And then the very end of King's career was the Memphis garbage strike in 68 with those unforgettable images of garbage workers holding signs saying, "I am a man," by which they meant, "We're contributing to the well-being of Memphis. We insist on recognition for that." So the spirit of work that actually makes a contribution, in fact, Franklin Roosevelt was one of our great presidents on this theme, and when he created the Civilian Conservation Corps in 1933, his address to Congress said, as important as the material contributions are, and of course the CCC created the nation's park system, he said, but more important than any material contributions will be the moral and spiritual value of the work that these young men do. And I would say that that's the larger meaning of work in the American tradition, that work is not only for private benefit, it's for public good.
Hmm. I wonder if you could just say a word about the vast array of jobs which people can have in modern society, and the fact that certain kinds of jobs, certain kinds of work seem to fold very naturally, beautifully, in fact, into what you were just describing. But I think a lot of us have maybe trouble with other kinds of jobs or professions or work being of that kind of value. You know what I'm asking?
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I think there again, we've seen such a narrowing of work to be, you know, a discipline, a particular expert fix-it approach. So a decade ago, or 15 years ago, we worked with a provost at the University of Minnesota on the land-grant tradition at the university. Bob Brunix was the provost. And my portfolio was working with and getting feedback from stakeholders in the community. And so we had all sorts of roundtables and discussions, and Minnesota Public Radio chipped in with a statewide discussion. But one of the things that really struck me in talking to, say, business leaders in the Twin Cities or clergy or school teachers or politicians in the legislature was how when we talked about the university reviving its public soul, its spirit of preparing citizens, people wanted to talk about their own institutions. So the business leadership in the Twin Cities used to have a tradition of being citizen business people who had a sense of responsibility and rootedness in the Twin Cities. They had a 10% club, so the businesses at every level would give 10% of their profits back to the civic health of the Twin Cities. And same thing was true with clergy and school teachers. And so I think in many fields, we've seen a kind of erosion of the what I'd call the citizenship dimensions of work. And part of the point of this book is to tell actual stories where they're coming back.
Hmm. At one point in the book, mention is made of perhaps reapproaching the term of the craftsperson.
Yeah.
And this comes in chapter 10 of the book, so this is not part of your specific essay, but a really interesting essay by Roman Coles and Blase Scanati called Transformational Ecotones, the Craftsperson Ethos in Higher Education. That's a kind of formidable, intimidating title. But at it, the heart and soul of this is talking about how, although in many cases someone we think of as a craftsperson is sort of poles apart from the upper echelon of higher education and what we sort of tend to think of as what that world is all about. I wonder if you remember this essay enough to comment on that notion.
Well, and we've done a lot of work on the concept of craft. I've done a lot of writing about it, and we work with it, the concept, in our own partnerships. So if you think about craft, it's different than a kind of detached expert notion of excellence. Their crafts have excellence, but they're particular. They are actually individual, so it's not generic. They're relational, so craft develops meaning in the context of relationships and places and people. It's unique, so each craftsperson has a distinctive contribution to make. The teaching is relational. You have apprenticeship relations with people, with students who are becoming craftspersons. And I would say the notion of democratic or civic craft is much the same as the idea of citizen professional, someone who sees their work as having excellences, but not individual, not simply by themselves or for their own only private benefit, but actually makes a contribution to the life of the place that they're working in or to the society. So there's a sense of democratic excellence in the notion of civic craft that we think is really crucial. And we have a lot of examples of that in the book and in our own work. We're working with the education department at Augsburg College and also the nursing department, both of which have picked up these ideas. So they're preparing citizen teachers and citizen nurses who imagine themselves as change agents and learning the skills of making constructive change in their professions. They're not just going to fit in. They're actually really fired up with redesigning their professions in more more collaborative, democratic ways.
I think what you just said now helps to clarify much of what this book is about. So that, for instance, person A, who becomes a nurse, the notion of being, in a sense, a civic nurse means not just being as good a nurse as you can possibly be and in effect, doing good things for every single patient with whom you come in contact, but that beyond that, being an agent for change for the greater good when it comes to the nursing profession or the policies of the hospital where you work.
Right. And the culture of your unit and taking leadership in the community. And knowing the skills of how to do that. These are not simply questions of goodwill. They're actually practical, everyday skills of learning how to work with people who make you uncomfortable, learning to understand the politics of the environment you're working in, the everyday politics, learning how to have a bigger vision of where change might be going. And, you know, one of the big opportunities and challenges in healthcare is to see healthcare is not a standalone system of provision, but actually something we all are responsible for. So how can health be the function of whole communities? That's definitely the future. So it involves lifestyle, it involves families, it involves nutrition, it involves environmental questions. So citizen nurses at Augsburg are imagining that they will take on those kinds of issues. They'll think about health is something belonging to the whole community, not simply to themselves.
Right. This also brings us back to that notion of hopelessness that so many people feel. And as we were talking about that earlier, I was thinking about that more in the context of, you know, as I sit here and I think about all of these big problems out there over which I have little or no control, or direct control at least, and often just feel like throwing up my hands and not doing anything about climate change or whatever it might be. But you're speaking here, now I'm starting to think about how that hopelessness can also operate on a more specific level, where even within a person's own sphere, my wife is a public school teacher, and she and many of her colleagues feel a pervasive sense of hopelessness at the moment in terms of they feel like decisions are being made about their work and the lives they lead and what it means to be a teacher and the resources they'll be given and the restrictions on what they do are being made far, far away from them by people over whom they have no influence whatsoever. And I think many, many teachers, just to give one example, feel very disempowered to affect their own profession.
No, absolutely. So one of the great things about the Augsburg teaching department is that we've seen students really fired up with the idea that they can make change. They can be creators of the kind of educational system we need. And the special education program has led here. Your wife would know that special education is in virtually every high school where they're the kids who are is labeled with learning and emotional and disabilities. But in Augsburg, special education has taken an approach to work with students or work with schools so that special education kids become public and empowered people. So we've seen really remarkable, in 15 schools across the Twin Cities, we've seen remarkable examples of kids who were locked away, stigmatized, labeled as failures, becoming community leaders on issues like bullying and healthy lifestyles. And of course, what that means for the college students is that they develop a whole different sense of what they can do in their careers. There are 31 students at Augsburg working in different sites around this idea of empowering their students, and a lot of teachers have really gotten on board here. So they're pushing back against the forces which constrict people's sense of power. Hmm.
So are you talking then, for instance, about universities, in a sense, altering their curriculum in order to address this? So that, for instance, when someone learns to be a teacher or learns to be an engineer or learns to be a doctor, that part of what they would be taught is the importance of changing their professions and of being given the tools to do so.
Exactly. And also developing an identity as a citizen professional. But that's exactly right. And I think that's the frontier of curricular change. So it's also focusing on civic skills, not simply knowledge transfer. But it's also, there are a lot of opportunities in co-curricular activities. One of the essays in the book by Adam Weinberg, who's president at Denison, talks about all the activities and student affairs and in the dorms and student life that students can learn from how to be effective problem solvers and citizens who will take those skills into their future. So it needs to be powerfully in the curriculum, but also in co-curricular activities.
He writes at one point, student organizations are another lost opportunity. If one treats the campus as community, then student organizations are our local associations.
That's
Imagine
exactly
using
right.
the language of civic opportunity and public work to get student organizations to understand themselves as community-based organizations.
Yes, no, absolutely. And we have some good examples. So Denison and Weinberg's earlier work at Colgate or University of Maryland, Baltimore County, where the whole student government has redesigned itself to think about itself as an empowering center for civic life of students. So it's had a big impact on the student culture.
Where do you see the most significant serious resistance to these ideas coming from? Do you think are there sort of organized, concerted, conscious obstacles being put in place, to discourage this kind of work from happening? Or is it simply just a matter that it just hasn't been, in a sense, thought of until now?
Well, no, there are a lot of obstacles. So you can't be too, roseate or panglossy in here. But, I would say that higher education, especially the research universities, have developed an ivory tower culture of detachment. There's a lot of research that shows the research cultures have become more detached over the last half century. So they're, it's not really that what people want, but it's the way that they know how to be an expert on top and deliver their knowledge. And so we've lost a lot of the older traditions of faculty, as citizen faculty who work in collaboration with communities. That's part of the challenge. And so we're talking both about identities, but we're also talking about incentive structure. So as long as rankings define excellence by exclusivity, which is one of the metrics, but also reputation, so your scholars are supposed to be internationally known, it discourages involvement in local communities. So I think they're very powerful incentive challenges that we face. There are also political challenges, and I think part of the democracy point that is promising is that it's a cross-partisan approach to dealing with the attacks on higher education today.
Well, your book gives us a great deal to think about. And again, it's titled Democracy's Education, Public Work, Citizenship, and the Future of Colleges and Universities. By the way, could you say a word about how you assembled this array of very interesting essays that follow your own? I mean, what sort of call to arms did you issue?
Well, we've been working for a number of years on revitalizing the democratic soul of higher education. From really the largest work we did directly was, as I said, with the provost at the University of Minnesota. We helped him put together a task force on the land-grant tradition. But in the last decade or so, we've worked with state colleges and universities and liberal arts schools. The Office of Public Engagement in the White House in 2011 asked if I would put together a coalition of colleges and universities interested in strengthening the idea that higher education is a public good, not simply a private benefit. And that was for the 150th anniversary of the land grant legislation, the Morrill Act, that Lincoln signed in 1862. So these essays really come out of that one-year coalition to celebrate and the land grant tradition, but also to develop strategies and approaches to strengthen the public purpose of higher education.
Well, I hope a lot of people will seek out your book and explore it deeply. There is a lot that gets us thinking about the valuable role that higher education can play. I happen to teach at a local liberal arts college in the music department, and although I find myself incredibly happy in what I do, where I do it, I know that I have colleagues in other departments, and I can think of peers at other schools who find themselves in increasingly difficult positions. One of the quotes in the book that kind of haunts me is, I believe it's in the same chapter about the whole notion of the craftsperson ethos, where somebody writes, "We find ourselves in shrinking, pressurized boxes, increasingly governed by imperatives that have little to do with our craft." Yeah. I have a feeling a whole lot of teachers at all kinds of different levels, not even at the higher education level, can really identify with those disturbing words.
No, I think that's the challenge we face.
The book, again, is Democracy's Education, Public Work, Citizenship, and the Future of Colleges and Universities, published by Vanderbilt University Press. Professor Harry C. Boyd, thank you for joining me today on The Morning
Show.
Thanks,
Greg. This is a pleasure.
You are enjoying the spectacular music making of Fifth House, the Fifth House Ensemble, which has a close collaborative relationship with Carthage College and its music department, where, of course, I teach. and where Fifth House has really brought a splendid spark of new life and excitement. And joining me today for this portion of the morning show is Melissa Snoza, who is executive director of Fifth House, and she plays the flute for them. She teaches flute at Carthage. And Melissa has joined us before. I know she was with us early last summer to talk about one of their most exciting undertakings for the whole year, namely the so-called Fresh Ink Festival, which is going on right now at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And this is a two-week feast of music making, featuring a number of young musicians in collaboration with the professionals of the Fifth House Ensemble. And Melissa, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you here. Before we talk about Fresh Ink specifically, let's give all of our listeners a good introduction to what Fifth House itself is all about and some of the exciting things that you do. First of all, remind us of when it was created and under what circumstances.
Absolutely. So we were created in 2005, so we're getting ready to celebrate our 10th anniversary year this year, which is really, really exciting. Mm. So we are a large mixed instrumentation chamber music ensemble. And what I mean by that is we have 10 instrumentalists in our group. We work with no conductor. And we also have a composer in our group now as well, Dan Visconti, who is also on faculty at the Fresh Ink Festival. And the group formed with a group of friends, actually, who all went through the Civic Orchestra of Chicago, or at least most of us had been through that program. And many of us had been through the Music Corps program that also exists at Civic. And what's really special about that is that it sends you out into all these different places, whether they be schools or parks or public places, to do concerts. And while we really loved the idea of playing in Symphony Center, wonderful repertoire with great conductors for fantastic audiences, there was something really special about having the control over how you present music and selecting what you're going to play, how you're going to speak about it, where it's going to be, and being really right up close to your audience so that you can see those light bulbs go off in their eyes. And so for us, what Fifth House was all about was redefining how we could present chamber music in so many different ways. And so that's how that's evolved for us, is that we have a series of concerts that we do in the Chicago area in which we really experiment with venues, with using music as a vehicle for storytelling, and with collaborations with artists of all different disciplines. So graphic novelists, actors, dancers, all kinds of things. And then we've extended that into the classroom. So from our very first year, we started doing arts integrated residencies for students grades K through 12. And what that means is that we're teaching music in core curricular classrooms. So we might be doing a music and poetry residency or a music and math residency and partnering with teachers on creating original curriculum. And in addition to that, we also do a lot of work now with higher education. So we're in residence at Carthage. We've been really excited to do that and to build a chamber music program there. And we've also been in residence in multiple universities and conservatories nationwide, really helping to redefine the training process for emerging artists.
Hmm. How much of what you do, because we think of Fifth House as being all about the new in so many ways, in terms of new ways of thinking about making music and the way collaborations can occur across sometimes artistic divides or that we wouldn't immediately think belong together. And of course, you make them belong together in some exciting ways. How much of what you do is standard repertoire? I mean, the music of Mozart, for instance, or Luigi Boccherini, versus brand new music, which you are creating in more ways than one. How are those elements balanced in what Fifth House does?
Absolutely. Great question. So we tend to get branded by the press as a new music group because
Right. People
think of us that way, but actually we're not. And ever since the beginning, we've been doing a pretty good balance of really traditional repertoire alongside repertoire that was just written yesterday. So what we tend to do with that is weave it together using some of these collaborations. For instance, this last year, we did Schoenberg's Verklärungsnacht with an original animation by a video artist who is just moved to LA. We're really sad to lose her in Chicago, but she created the most amazing, stunning visuals to go along with this really traditional masterwork. Hmm. And we've also, because of the storytelling aspect of what we do, we've been able to put pieces together that you normally wouldn't think to do on a program. So a few years ago, we did a concert that was about Cinderella and the Devil. It was a mashup of two different fairy tales with live actors, and that allowed us to put the Beethoven septet next to a piece by Elliot Carter, because the Carter was the perfect place for the Devil to be chopping people up and throwing them in the closet. And that's really just not, those aren't pieces that you would typically expect to see on the same program, but we do a really good balance of both, and it's very challenging, actually.
Right. Well, I should think, I mean, first of all, yes, to do all of that well. And in some respects, that's so much more interesting and in some ways so much more innovative than to be just an ensemble that just performs brand new music hot off the press, although that can be quite exciting. But at least I, for one, am very inspired by the notion of making all of these things fit together somehow. I mean, that seems artistically to be the real summit of doing something new.
Absolutely. And last year, we started delving into world music a little bit, too. We actually brought in April, a Mediterranean folk band from Israel called Balladino. And together, we were exploring a mixture of American folk music alongside Ladino folk music, which is Judeo-Spanish music, right? And what was really exciting about that is we were working with a group that works in a completely different way than we do. I mean, as classical musicians, we're used to reading from the page and really preparing in that way. And they write a lot of their music together collaboratively in a room. So for us to have such a short time together, we met in Berlin for 5 days, and then I think we had 10 days in Chicago before our first show. Just to put everything together was an incredible process. But we're so proud of what came out of that. I mean, you know, it stretched us as musicians, both on both sides. And it was a really exciting time for us to be exploring what it means to have music in our cultural lives.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Melissa Snoza, who is the executive director of Fifth House, and their flutist as well. And they are right in the middle, I mean, almost exactly in the middle of a two-week musical workshop going on at the University of Wisconsin Parkside called Fresh Ink. When was the first Fresh Ink?
It was in 2012.
Okay, so it's been around several years. We've talked about it at least once, maybe twice. Explain to our listeners what happens at Fresh Ink.
Wow, what doesn't happen at Fresh Ink? It's a very, very busy 2 weeks. So we bring young instrumentalists and composers to Wisconsin to create 16 new works of chamber music and present them in public. So we're rehearsing in groups that are mixed between participating musicians and members of Fifth House Ensemble, which is a really great way for us to be working. We're not coaching groups from the outside. We're actually in there performing alongside, and that's in many ways the best way to learn from one another. And I think that we as artists get as much from that experience as folks who are joining us for the first time. But what's really exciting is that we're not just playing for each other. We're actually doing something like 12 performances in 14 days. And all of the venues are spread between Milwaukee, Kenosha, Racine, Chicago. And they range from really traditional concert venues like Rush Hour Concerts at St. James Cathedral in Chicago to places like the Kenosha Public Library, or we've played at the Racine Art Museum before. Yesterday, we were at the Milwaukee Art Museum. And so we're looking to interact with as many different kinds of audiences as we can, and also to make sure that we're giving the artists who join us as much of a springboard into their careers as possible through as many ears as possible hearing their music. And while they're here, we're also putting them through a rather rigorous curriculum of entrepreneurship, business skills, creative presentation techniques. Really what we're giving them are the things that we were missing in school when we graduated. And all of the things that we were needing when we were starting Fifth House that we had to scratch at the earth and research how to do.
In terms of functioning as young professional musicians, outside of the actual music making, the matter of, in a sense, handling your own small business.
Exactly right. So yesterday we had our first workshop, which I call Arts Startup. And essentially what it does is it goes over what your point of difference is, what your point of view is as an artist. And once you figure out what it is that you're trying to do, what are the different business structures you have available to you to support that? What are the tax implications of each? How do you govern each? What are the starting documents you need to file for each one? And some of this might not be information that they'll use tomorrow, but they have information that they can take home with them. And at whatever point they decide to start a venture, they can actually go in and reference that, as opposed to sitting on the floor of the library like I did for a really long time.
Well, plus you are... they are learning it from people who are doing it. So it's not just in the abstract of the classroom. or somebody teaching about something that they themselves were only using, you know, years earlier. I mean, you are all relatively young professional musicians, and you know the way in which these tools work in real life, in the real world.
Absolutely.
Applicability, that's what you know firsthand.
Absolutely. And as I said about the performance side of what we're doing at Fresh Ink, we learn as much from our participants as we give to them often, because especially when we're talking about marketing and social media and all those things, new tools pop up all the time. We just did our first Periscope broadcast from the Milwaukee Art Museum, which was super exciting. And that's, you know, a new platform where it's connected to Twitter and you can live stream little moments. So it's almost as if you're putting up a Periscope in someone else's life and seeing what they're up to. So, you know, there are new things happening all the time, and we learn a lot from the folks who come here. And everything we cover, I mean, it's everything from, you know, how to start a business to how to market it, how to do fundraising. But then on the presentation side, public speaking for musicians. I mean, we all know that this is something we have to do, but it's terrifying. I mean, the fear of public speaking is more prevalent than the fear of death. And then, you know, how to work with an outside collaborator who's outside of the discipline of music, and so many different things. And there's a whole track for composers as well who join us too.
That's cool. How many young musicians are we talking about who come to work with you?
Usually each year we have somewhere between 40 and 50.
And from all over the country.
Absolutely right. They're coming from some of the country's best music schools.
And real quick, this matter of you making music together, does that mean then, for instance, whatever small group of musicians you're playing with, you're the flutist, and it might be with an oboist and a horn player and a bassoonist, and you're the, in a sense, resident professional in that small little group. Is that kind of how it works?
Absolutely. The only exception to that is that we have a couple of preformed ensembles who join us as a group. Like, they come to the festival as a group to develop themselves. So in those cases, we may not have a faculty member in there, but every other group has a good balance between both sides, which
great.
Is great.
And in many cases, these are young musicians who maybe don't know each other before they come.
Absolutely.
Wow. How
so
exciting.
In 2 weeks' time, they've got to get to know each other really well and play some really great music. And, you know, one thing I'll say about Fresh Ink, which I find really exciting, is that the musicians who come, for some reason, this festival and what it's about attracts really wonderful human beings, which is great. And the other thing that's really exciting about it is that we're giving a lot of practical information, but because we're in a place where the people who are here are excited about starting new projects, and the people who are here are excited about getting to know each other and are good people and are also very good at what they do, we've seen a ton of new projects start out of this festival. New commissions, new CD projects, new ensembles, touring models. We've seen people inviting each other to each other's schools. I mean, it's really exciting.
Ah, it's tremendous. So we want to let our listeners know, first of all, about a performance coming up tomorrow, Saturday, June 13th at 2 p.m. at the Kenosha Public Library. That's the Southwest Branch. That's a place where actually music gets presented on a fairly regular basis. And this is a free program, 2 o'clock at the Southwest Public Library. Melissa, tell us about what's coming up after that. I don't know, too many of our listeners will make their way down to downtown Chicago for the presentation on Tuesday evening, but what about on Wednesday?
Absolutely. Well, I will say, by the way, if you're not able to come down for Tuesday at Rush Hour's Concerts at St. James, at 5:45, that will actually live broadcast. So you could go to WFMT.com and check that out.
Great.
And that's going to be music by Dan Visconti and Stacey Garup, who are our two composers. Fifth House is going to be performing on that, which is a really fun thing.
Terrific. I know that kind of a culminating event will be at Parkside on a week from Sunday. That'll be the 21st of June, 2 p.m. in beautiful Francis Bedford Concert Hall. And then say a quick word about these other presentations at Parkside known as the Salon Nights.
Absolutely. So Salon Nights are a very informal, fun evening for participants to play literally whatever they want. I mean, we've had everything from Michael Jackson covers to experimental music to very traditional music. So during the festival, we're actually working on a lot of pieces that may or may not be performed on some of our more public concerts off campus. So that's another place where those can go. But they're free. They're open to the public. They are also at UW Parkside at the Rita, which is the Performing Arts Center. And we're in room D184, which is their big rehearsal room there. So please feel free to join us if you'd like to hear a fun, informal concert.
Cool. For more information about Fifth House and Fresh Ink, what is your website?
It's freshinkfestival.com, but the ink is spelled I-N-C. So double entendre, where it's like newly inked works and also we're starting new projects.
Excellent. Melissa Snoza, great to connect with you again. Congrats to you and all of your colleagues at Fifth House.
Thank you.